Okay, folks, welcome to the latest chapter, the latest edition, the latest exciting movements in and around life on Planet Porky, with, of course, myself, the Porkmeister, and the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Miss Jones, how are we today?
Very good, Michael, thank you. How's it hanging?
It's hanging, funny you should say that, because it's not hanging well from my hips down, okay?
What's happened?
For the past couple of months, I've had strange sensations sort of around my midriff and in my back.
Do we want to know this?
Oh, yes. It's all perfectly family-oriented. Don't worry.
Family show.
Sorry?
Family show.
Yeah, family show, absolutely.
Oh, I'm a bit croaky here this morning.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I think it's because, you know, we've had a few early mornings this week. A couple of months ago, I got back from a job late at night, got out the car, walked to my place, and then I have to step up one step to get to the door. And my right leg went underneath me. And I thought, that's funny. I must have slipped on. They must have polished the step or something like that. You know what I mean? And didn't really think any more of it. But then last week, exactly the same thing happened on the first step of the stairs. I have to go up to the lift. And my leg buckled right underneath me, and I tumbled over and, you know, was in such a difficult position I couldn't get up. Unfortunately, one of my neighbours came along and helped me up, but I don't know what it is, but I kind of lose power in my legs occasionally, particularly my right one. You can't put any weight on it, and it gives you a bit of a, you know, a disconcerting feeling. But anyway.
Did you see the Brit Awards this year?
Yes.
So did you see when Anne-Marie was coming down a little staircase on the stage when she was singing, doing her performance?
Yeah.
And the same thing happened to her. We all thought she did a Madonna and tripped on the steps in her great big boots.
Yes.
But she tweeted afterwards that her leg just gave way underneath
her. Right, okay. So
it could be a similar thing. I wonder what causes it.
Well, I can't work out whether it's coming from my hip or my knee, because my knee felt very sore afterwards, but that's because I think I went down on my knee. But the actual, I'm sure it's neurological, and I'm not trying to make out I've got some terrible disease or something, but these things can happen to people in phases, you know, and it only comes on very rarely, but when it does, it's terribly disconcerting to think that you can't support your body on your legs, you know what I mean? For instance, after the latest episode, I went into a pub on the way back from a job somewhere, and I thought, I'm not going to feel safe carrying this pint of beer from the bar to the table. So I asked the guy to bring it over just in case my leg went. You see what I mean? So it does sort of unsettle you a bit. But look, thank God we've got a great NHS system in this country, and I will go and see a quack and find out if I can find out what's going on, you know?
This is not the old Vino Collapso, is it?
It wasn't Vino Collapso. No, definitely not. No, on the first occasion, I'd had nothing to drink because I'd come in from a late evening job on telly and got a car straight home. And on the second occasion, no, definitely not. It was kind of lunchtime. And I've been out to get my hair cut. So, again, there was no drink involved there. So maybe I'm like...
Well, keep an eye on it. Check in with your GP. Yeah. And, you know, it's worth asking the question.
Oh, no, it certainly is. I totally agree. I tell you what, there's a very strange story knocking around, which I'm sure has interested you as much as me, and that is that the boy George and his fellow band members all appear now to be suing each other, accusing each other of swindling each other out of money. But what gets me is the sums of money involved are not rock star style money. Do you remember when Sting was once in a high court case suing somebody and didn't realise £5 million of his fortune had gone missing because it was such a small part of his fortune? And those are the sort of figures you think about with rock stars. But in this case, Boy George has fallen out with the guy who was the drummer. I think that was John Moss, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
And who claims they had an affair, but Boy George has denied it. But the sum concerned is £180,000. I mean, you know, you couldn't even buy a bedsit in London for that sort of money.
We have to remember that Boy George and Culture Club have not been rock stars for a really long time. Mm. I mean, they've been going 37 years, but for the past 20 years, not really. Mm. You know, they're not major high-profile stars the way they once were. What happened here is that there was a tour, and John Moss, who's the drummer, claimed he was expelled from the band in 2018 after 37 years of what he called service. Mm-hmm. And there was an outstanding balance that was owed. So he's not suing George personally. He's suing all the members of the band. Mm-hmm. So also Mikey Craig and Roy Hay are involved in this. So it's not a personal attack on George.
Yeah.
And it's the balance of the outstanding balance of what he claims he's owed. So, you know, it tells you how much he needs the dosh, basically.
Yeah, that's right. No, I totally agree. And so what's he claiming? Why was he chucked out the band then in the middle of a tour?
It was supposed to be a managerial decision. Right. Perhaps, you know, people lose their touch over the years. Yeah. Maybe whoever the management is now decided that he wasn't a good enough drummer anymore. I don't know. Yeah. I'm not casting aspersions. Yeah. That could be one reason.
Yeah, could be.
But, I mean, George has been involved in lots of scandal over the years.
Yes.
I remember back in the 80s when he declared he was a heroin addict. I mean, I used to hang out with George quite a lot. I remember spending a night in the boot of a car with him once.
Yes, he told me, yeah.
Yeah, we were hiding from someone. Yeah. He had a massive sort of gothic house up on Hampstead Heath. Hmm. And there we were in the boot of this car with a bottle of wine. He's a gigantic bloke, by the way.
A gigantic bloke, massive.
Oh, George is, He's not a little shy, retiring sort of wallflower. So there wasn't much room in the boot for me.
No, I shouldn't think there was. I know how big he is because I did their first ever tour. I was living and working in America in New York. I'm sure I've told the audience a bit of this before, but I had to go up to Montreal or somewhere where Boy George and his band were starting their North American tour. And that's where the first allegations of this rumour between him and John Moss came out. But George is a huge bloke. He fell off a ladder because he was, you know, on drugs and that kind of stuff. And the crash that, you know, heralded his arrival on the ground was enormous. You know, absolutely, he used to wear dresses in those days, you know.
I tell you what, though, he's a much calmer chameleon than he used to be.
Yeah, I'm sure he is,
That was a joke, by the way.
The Karma Chameleon. Oh, that's very good. Karma Chameleon.
Good song, that, wasn't it?
Oh, it's beautiful.
I've got a really good friend called Judd Lander who plays the harmonica on that track.
Really? Plays the harmonica? Gosh, that's amazing. Talking about bands being out and about, I was amazed to see a full-page advert in a newspaper this week heralding that Roxy Music are back on tour. But I couldn't see from the promotional stuff whether Brian Ferry's in the band or not. There was a bloke there with a small portrait picture who looked a bit like Brian Ferry, but I don't think it was Brian Ferry. Is he still with the group?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but Brian Ferry's 76 now, so he's not going to look like the Brian Ferry you've probably got in mind.
That's true.
But, yeah, it's Brian, it's Andy Mackay, Phil Manzanera and Paul Thompson.
Ah.
Together for the first time since their 2011 tour, which is what? 11 years ago?
Yep.
It's quite a long time, actually,
yep.
isn't it? And this is the 50th anniversary.
Oh.
So they're kicking off in America doing 10 arena shows.
Yes.
And then they come to the UK in October.
Right.
The best story about Brian Ferry, and I think we may have touched on this before, is the fact that he nicked his son's girlfriend.
Yes.
And now he's married
yes,
to her.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that is utterly amazing. Of course, he lost one very famous girlfriend to Mick Jagger, didn't he? Jerry Hall.
And yes, and he was married to Lucy Helmore.
Yeah.
They had four children. She killed herself in the end.
Oh, dear.
But, I'm sure it wasn't because she was married to him. But I think she had mental health problems.
Right.
But, I mean, this fascinates me to the point that, honestly, I think about this every Christmas.
Yeah, go on.
I sit there and I think, that is a Christmas dinner table to avoid, isn't it?
Oh, God.
You're there with your new wife,
yes.
who's, what is she, 36 years younger than Brian.
That's right.
And your son, Isaac, is sitting at the table, and she used to be your girlfriend.
Yeah, that's right.
That's really weird, isn't it?
It is.
So you're sitting there thinking, that's my dad, and he's making the beast with the two backs with my ex.
Yeah, it is unbelievable. I mean, even if you're Brian Ferry's son, it's very hard to compete with him to attract the favours of a woman, isn't it? And, and the reason I say that is I once broke up with a girl because she was obsessed by Brian Ferry. Now, I'm talking about when I was a very young man working on a weekly newspaper, And the girl I was going out with worked on the other weekly newspaper in the town, and she was very good looking. I mean, she was beautiful, honestly, this girl. Long, dark hair and very, you know, very good looking. But she was obsessed by Brian Ferry because she, you know, believed in style, and she had a lovely fur coat because they weren't actually banned in those days, or banned in sort of good society, you know. And she was always going on about Brian Ferry. And one time I said, look, you've got to shut up about Brian Ferry. You're getting on my nerves. You know what I mean? And then we had a big row about it. And that was it. It all ended.
Did she think you looked like Brian Ferry?
No, not at all. Because I had copper hair in those days. You know, auburn, copper, ginger.
Did you?
Yes, yes. I know it's snowy.
I remember you as having really dark hair and a massive great beard.
Well, that was when it went from sort of auburn to sort of brown, if you see what I mean. And then it went like grey, and now it's snowy white.
You're a silver fox, very
silver
distinguished
fox
looking.
Is a good word. But I don't know how any other bloke could have got on with her in those days because of this obsession. She, you know, she had pictures of Brian Ferry on a wall, despite the fact she was like 21 or something like that, you know. But there you go.
Do you know what most people say about him?
Yeah.
Because he was 66 when he got together with this woman, Amanda Shepherd. They got married.
Right.
He was 66. She was 29. And they just say, quite honestly, he's a dirty old man.
Well, you know, horses for courses, isn't it, really? I mean, is the marriage still going now?
Yeah.
Well, it's lasted the course then, hasn't it? You know.
Yeah, but it's still your son's girlfriend. Because he stole her. It wasn't as if they'd broken up and then the dad and the girlfriend got together. It wasn't even that.
Right, I see.
That would have been a bit easier, wouldn't it, to cope with?
Yeah.
But no, this was actually an out-and-out theft of your child's partner. I sat there thinking about what would happen if, you know, with say, for example, I've got two daughters. Mm. What would happen if I nicked one of their boyfriends?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, listen, there have been lots of cases of it happening the other way around, haven't there? Old bloke marries young woman, but then old bloke's son starts knocking off the younger bride. You see what I mean? That's happened plenty of times, hasn't it?
Has it? Yeah, well, I've never heard of that.
Well, funnily enough, I remember years ago, and it's still running today, because there's a series on TV called Classic Coronation Street. I know you're not a TV watcher, but I've loved Coronation Street all my life, and occasionally, if I'm home by sort of 4 o'clock, you know, after working mornings or whatever, I occasionally switch it on. And the plot at the moment is all about Mike Baldwin, who is the factory owner. He runs Underworld.
Is he still alive, Mike Baldwin?
No, he's not. No, he, I can't. What?
Oh, sorry. This is, you're watching the classic.
Yeah. Mike Baldwin is a character, by the way, not the actor.
I know.
I forgot the name of that. No, Johnny Briggs.
Johnny Briggs. So he's died, has he?
Yeah, he died a few years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, I think. But he was a great actor, great character actor. And so he runs the factory and, you know, a girl comes to work as a machinist in the factory. She's very good looking, catches Mike Baldwin's eye. Lo and behold, he sweeps her away and she's off the factory floor and is suddenly the boss's wife. But the other person who runs the factory is Mike Baldwin's son, who's the same age as new bride. And he and she get together behind the scenes and make a complete fool of Mike Baldwin, you know, who's providing them with a great house. He's got her a car, you know, she becomes a lady who lunches and all that. But the person she's lunching with is Mike Baldwin's son. And, of course, it all ends in terrible family turmoil. But it's not unheard of for those sort of things to happen. Now, Miss Jones, you've got another book coming out this summer. Why do I keep reading pieces from distinguished journalists, stroke authors, stroke book writers about the art of writing a book? You always seem to make it look easy, but I do know enormous effort goes into it because I've written a couple of books myself and I've vowed never to write one again. It's just too much like hard work.
I think one of the reasons might be that a lot of people in these hard times see all these books out there and they think, I could write a book, actually. What could I do to generate income is usually the thing that spurs them on in the first place.
Yes.
Oh, because professional authors do make it look easy, I think vast numbers of people out there think, well, I could do that.
Yeah.
You know, I'll have a go at that. And it's not until they actually try that they realise so much more goes into it than the words on the page. I always, when I'm doing workshops and coaching people in writing,
right,
I always use the analogy of the swan. Mm-hmm. So a beautiful swan is floating down the river, yeah, and it looks very elegant and serene. Mm. And we do not see the manically paddling, what are they called? Their feet.
Yeah.
What do we call a swan's feet?
You know, it's escaped me. They are like paddles, aren't they?
They've got kind of webbed feet, haven't they? Yeah. But they're
flippers.
Whatever they're called.
Anyway, they're treading water, aren't they?
They're sort of going 19 to the dozen under the surface of the water, and we don't see how much effort is going into that swan gliding along serenely.
That's right.
And writing a book is a lot like that. Mm. There are so many elements to it that most people just don't know. Mm. I mean, for example, I spent about 11 hours yesterday and last night going through the copy edit of my latest manuscript.
Yeah.
And the next stage along will be the legal read and the comments from the lawyers.
Right.
Can we get away with this? Might somebody sue us?
Yes.
Do we need to tone this down a little bit? Mm-hmm. You know, all of that. Mm. And sometimes I talk to my mum about these various elements along the way of the job that I'm working on currently, and her eyes glaze over, literally. Mm. She says, I just don't know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So there are lots and lots of stages. It's not a question of when you hand in the manuscript to the publisher, that's the end of your contribution. By no means is it that.
No.
You've then got another 6 months of working with various different editors to turn that into a book.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Now, you'll believe this, Miss Jones, it's not widely known, but I have currently got a book out. It was released last week in Belfast. It's called Reporting the Troubles. And, excuse me, when I say I've got a book out, I'm being rather big-headed there, because it's about reporting in Northern Ireland at the height of the Troubles, probably during the late 70s and throughout the, all the 70s, actually, in the early 80s. And I was one of, I think, it's about 30 journalists asked to contribute a chapter to reporting there. And I spent a lot of time in Ireland, but the first time I ever worked there on a story involving the Troubles was the murder of Lord Mountbatten at Mullaghmore near Sligo in the Irish Republic. And I had to get over there and do it. And it was amazing, 6 days and all that kind of stuff, you know. But my report of that is in this book. But I feel very humble and very honoured to have been asked to write a chapter there, because some of the journalists who have contributed to this book worked in Ireland for 15 years non-stop, and, you know, saw every movement, every nuance, every persuasion from both sides of the sectarian divide. And really, you know, it was a very difficult place to work. And how those guys did it week in, week out, I don't know. The guy who's put it all together is a lad called Derek Henderson. And Derek's probably the finest journalist I ever worked with. He was Mr. Northern Ireland. He first of all worked on what we call the Bell Tell. That's the Belfast Telegraph, where lovely, fantastic evening paper that covered the whole of Northern Ireland, based in Belfast. From there, he went on to become the Irish editor of the Press Association. Nothing moved in Northern Ireland that Derek didn't know about. In fact, a lot of it moved because Derek was instrumental in making things happen. I mean, he's just a terrific guy, and he edited the book. But it does take me back to really dark period in British history. It wasn't a great place, Belfast, in those days, believe me. It was very exciting for young reporters to work there, but it was a horrible society, and I'm so glad now that we've got a peace deal.
Would that happen today? Would a journalist be able to be deployed for such long periods of time on one job? Because we're so aware of mental health and all that kind of thing today.
Well,
would a newspaper editor get away with that now?
Yeah, I think they would. I mean, I have to admit, and this is something, you know, which sends a shudder down my back all the time. When I first went there to report on the Troubles in Belfast, this was after the Mountbatten incident, my mum did ring up the news editor of the paper I was on and tell him how worried she was after she'd seen a report on the television of an explosion in Belfast centred around the Europa Hotel, which is where I was staying and living, you know. And and the news editor was very, very good about it. You know, he sort of contacted me privately and said, look, we had your mother, I think I was 23 at the time. We had your mother on the phone. And I said, I'm so sorry. I feel so embarrassed. He said, no, don't. He said, it's what mothers do. You know what I mean? But funny enough, happily enough, I'm not aware of any journalists having been killed in Northern Ireland, but there was a lot of intimidation. There was a lot of, you know, risk in things that you wrote and people arriving and knocking on your door late at night and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
Oh, dear. That's very
funny. Knocking on your bedroom door, you know, and wanting a word and all that kind of stuff. But nobody actually died. But I'm so proud to have been asked to write it. If anybody's interested, it's called Reporting the Troubles, and it's put together. Hang on, I've got a copy of it. Wait a minute, sorry about this. Here we are. It's called Reporting the Troubles. More journalists tell their stories of the Northern Ireland conflict, compiled by Derek Henderson and Ivan Little, with a foreword by Sir Tony Blair. And it's published by, who is it? The Black Staff Press. So there we go, Miss Jones. That's my contribution to the written world.
Did you receive a book from me in the post this week?
A book from you? Now, I did. Thank you ever so much. And I should have mentioned it to you. And again, I'm just going to have to get up from my desk and reach onto a shelf. Hang on. Right, got it.
I'll talk amongst myself.
No. It's all too much. Adventures of a Teenage Beatles Fan in the 60s and Beyond, David Stark. Tell our millions of listeners, please, Miss Jones, what this book is all about.
David Stark is a wonderful old friend of mine. He's worked in the music business all his life. Yeah. He worked at Decca, who famously turned down the Beatles. But he's one of those people, he's managed to find himself in the right place at the right time so many times throughout his life. And he's got pictures of himself, just kind of what we would nowadays call a crashing a selfie kind of pictures, where he's in the same photo as John Lennon, Paul McCartney. He managed to get himself into the premiere of A Hard Day's Night in Yellow Submarine, sitting in seats that John and Yoko hadn't turned up to take, and hiding in the roof of buildings and all kinds of stuff. A very intrepid person. He's also a brilliant drummer. He's got a band. He's got his own band called the Trembling Wilburys, who are a tribute act to, obviously, the Travelling Wilburys. And this book is just packed with his personal anecdotes, his stories, his experiences of the Beatles. Who he idolised from when he was a small boy.
Yeah, well, it's a brilliant book. I haven't had time to read it yet, but I certainly will. As you say, there's images. I'm looking at one image here, Miss Jones, and it says the Beatles hairdresser, Leslie Cavendish, with Leslie Ann Jones. What were you doing hanging out with the Beatles hairdresser for?
Oh, where were we? We were at the Gold Badge Awards, the Basker Gold Badge Awards at the Savoy.
Oh, yes.
And we were both special guests. Mm. So I think we both had, I must have had my John Lennon book out at the time, and he had his memoir of being the Beatles hairdresser. He's a really nice guy, Leslie Cavendish, actually. Yeah. But David's book, I wrote the foreword for it.
Oh, well done. That's brilliant. Excellent. Good. That's one to get stuck into. Right, folks, you're listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Portmeister, and, of course, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. And I have to say, Leslie Ann, how nice it was for people to respond to the return of the podcast coming out after we took a break in honour of the dreadful situation in Ukraine.
Oh, it's fantastic messages from people. Mm. One or two rat bags, but you always get them. You know, moving swiftly on from the rat bags.
Yeah, yeah.
Most people seem really pleased to have us back.
Yeah.
And I'm very pleased to be back.
Yes. No, me as well. Situation in Ukraine, I hope, is easing. I mean, they've been through terrible, terrible times. If you were able, Miss Jones, I know that, you know, you live now as a single person, having done your motherly duty to raising your three children. You know, I want a bit of privacy and quiet, and you've just moved to a new house. But if you were able, would you take in a Ukrainian mother and two children who were displaced by, you know, the terrible situation in Ukraine?
I think I definitely would if my circumstances were otherwise. Yeah. It's a tricky situation for me to take that on right now. I also think it's not advisable for a single woman to do such a thing.
Yes. Well, even if it's a young mother and young children that you're taking in.
Yeah, I think it's a huge thing for a single person.
Yeah.
To take on. What about you? Would you do it?
Well, I wouldn't do it in my own home, right? Because, you know, I've lived on my own largely for all my life. And I have a routine now, which is, you know, totally and selfishly adapted to my lifestyle. Sometimes I have to go out at 3:30 in the morning to get into a car and go to a studio to do a breakfast show or something like that. Sometimes I might be out all day or for 2 days. You know, I might have to go off somewhere working out of town or something like that. So I would never feel happy about being out of my house when other people were there. But I do have some buy-to-let properties, which is no secret. I've told people about my property portfolio over the years. I've gone and bought flats and that kind of stuff. And if one of those became vacant and it wasn't contracted, you know, to anybody else, I would definitely make it available to a young family from Ukraine if I thought it would help for maybe 12 months or something like that, you know?
Yeah, I think it's different if we know the people. So yes. I've got my former au pair, Misha, who's in Slovakia, and she says that the Russian troops are, what are they, about 150K from their border right now. And she said if they cross our border, we're going to run. Mm. So she means her husband, her two young children and her mother. Mm. And I wouldn't even think twice about driving to Paris. I said to her, just get on a train.
Yeah.
You can get from Bratislava to Stuttgart, change trains, go from Stuttgart to Paris. Mm. I will drive to Paris, pick you guys up, and you will all come and stay here. Mm. It'll be a bit like a dormitory, but that doesn't matter because I know the family.
Yes, of course.
And I think that's slightly different.
Yeah. No, of course.
When it's complete strangers, you know, as you say, you've got your routine, you're set in your ways, you have your way of doing things.
Yes.
It would be very difficult to juggle complete strangers in that situation.
Yeah. No, it would. You're absolutely right. Talking about, you know, the misery that's been inflicted on the people of Ukraine and a lot of other countries in Eastern Europe now fearing the yoke of the Russian tyrant Putin might suddenly fall upon them. But I was on a TV show the other day and I was asked if I have any self-guilt about being a baby boomer. And I suppose I do, but I can't really help it. You know what I mean? Can you have baby boomer guilt? I mean, the point that was put to me by younger people was that, you know, you got free university education, you worked in an industry that paid into pension funds for you, you're able to buy housing incredibly cheaply compared to what it is today. And, you know, you were getting a state pension and the women get a state pension at the age of 60 and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know if I've ever appreciated just how lucky our generation was. I don't think you are a boomer, are you, Miss Jones? I think you're just a bit too
young. I might come in just under the wire there,
exactly.
What I would say is that there's no reason to feel guilt. You had no say in the matter of when you were born.
Yeah.
That's just random and it's happenstance.
Mm.
You came along when you did. Why should you feel guilty about it? Because the younger generations who came after you haven't had it so good.
No, they haven't.
It's not a thing to feel guilty about. It isn't your fault.
No, I do try to help people out as much as I can because I know I'm better off than a lot of people and I contribute to charities. And if I can help people, and I've helped a lot of younger people during my life, generally I've been working in radio stations or something like that. I've seen somebody who's, you know, an assistant producer, all that, in despair. Oh, what's happened? Oh, something terrible's happened. They need £500 because they've smashed the car up or something, or, you know, something like that. Something terrible's happened, or split up with their girlfriend and had to find their own flat and all that kind of stuff. I have honestly tried to help out like that because I felt lucky that I was earning a very good salary and these youngsters were just starting and making their way in life. But that's the only thing you can do, really, is seek a profession, get in it and try and get as far as you can. I worked on Jeremy Vine a few days ago. And I was delighted to find that one of the young girls whose job was basically to pick me up in reception, take me to the green room, make me a cup of tea, get me a croissant, and then go and find out where my scripts were and all that, is now going off to call the midwife as an assistant producer. And I was thrilled for her, you know what I mean?
Well, this is how they progress in television, as we know. You know, so many of them start as runners and then become sort of second assistant producers and they work their way up and they eventually own their own channel. Mm. You know, I know people who've done that.
Yes.
A guy who I worked with, donkeys years ago, on a Channel 4 pop magazine show called Ear Set.
Oh, yeah.
Guy called Andy Harris. Mm-hmm. He was a lovely chap. He was my cameraman.
Yeah.
And we used to go out and do outside broadcasts together all over the place.
Mm.
Cut to this guy now owns the production company that conceived, made, filmed, and made a global success of The Crown.
Right. Right.
And that's his company.
Wow.
He owns it.
Wow, wow, wow.
I know. Well, so you go from being, yeah, you know, a junior cameraman, yeah, to that. Yeah. And that is how it works in TV.
Yeah, no. Oh, it is. Another young lady I've worked with over the years called Laura Woods, again, started as a runner, I think, on Channel 4. And funny enough, I was at a recent Everton game, at Crystal Palace, and the game was also televised live. So we had all the big screens in the lounge that I was in. And lo and behold, there's Laura hosting the show with Joe Cole, you know, and other distinguished footballers. And I knew she'd progressed up the ladder because she worked at TalkSport with me and went from being just an occasional guest to actually doing the breakfast show on some of the days at the start of the week, on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, actually. And I'm so thrilled for her because, you know, she's made such progress. She's on Sky all the time now. And that's what I like to see in young people. Don't be held back by wokedom, or don't be held back by, you know, trying to seek out problems in life that aren't there. Just get your head down, get on with it, and hopefully the rewards will come. And I think your children have always pursued that route, haven't they?
Yeah, of course, but we were no different, Mike.
No, we weren't. I agree.
You have to cast your mind back to when we were junior reporters.
Oh, definitely.
Out of nowhere, yeah. not any clue whatsoever about what we were doing. And I remember being sent out with theatre critic Jack Tinker and the columnist Linda Lee Porter, and literally learning at their knee. Mm. And we learned in those days, not by doing college courses in journalism. There was no such thing, really. There was an NCTJ qualification.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. But none of us did it.
Well, no, I did.
You learned.
I did.
Did you do
that? Yeah, I went to a training school in Newcastle-upon-Tyne, where I first developed my love for the northeast of England. And I went to the NCTJ training school in Big Market, run by Thompson Regional Newspapers, as it was in those days. And you had to pass an exam after 2 years and all that. I cheated on the shorthand because I couldn't do it. But I charmed one of the young ladies in the class to do it for me.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. That is an utter scandal, Michael.
It is a scandal. I got her to swap papers with me because she was so good. She could do it in, like, half the time of everybody else. So she did it for me as well and passed me one of the papers.
You need a certain type of brain to do shorthand. I obviously learned shorthand to become a journalist.
Yes.
Because I'm left-handed and I have a strange way of writing, you may have noticed.
Yes.
I hold the pen in such a way that my hand is upside down and I sort of scrawl across the page. Mm. So the whole thing of shorthand is that you generally write with your right hand and you're pulling the pen across and it skims very fast.
That's right.
I can actually write longhand faster than I can write shorthand.
Wow.
So shorthand was never any good to me.
Yeah, golly. The shorthand we did wasn't Pittman's, which is only, it was some new one. I forgot what it's called now, but I can still write it today. And I still do. You know, if I'm interviewing somebody or if I'm on a TV show and I'm trying to make notes on what the other person is saying to respond to them, I can still write it in shorthand and read it back in shorthand, you know. So I think it's a very valuable skill to have. It's just that I can't do it at the speed that you need to report. The best people in shorthand were always sent to the Old Bailey in the High Court to get a pitch-perfect, verbatim account of what the witnesses said.
I tell you, he was very, very good at shorthand, and his shorthand was so neat, was Roger Taverner.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, his shorthand was a work of art.
Really?
I couldn't read it yet, but it was beautifully conceived. I think I might still have one of his old reporter's notebooks around somewhere.
Golly.
And it was just so lovely. It was like a sort of cuneiform.
Yeah.
You know, as a beautiful example might be in a
textbook. Well, he was, you've got to give it to Rog. He was a very neat and tidy guy, wasn't he? You know, and handled himself very well. So I'm glad to see that he excelled in yet another talent. Now then, Miss Jones, I don't know if you've been following on Twitter, but the saga of my missing bin has finally been resolved. Because I live in an apartment block, I live in a penthouse. The bins are communal downstairs, okay, and hidden away in a bin shed. And I always have to make sure that the combination lock on the bin shed has been opened up, so to speak, on the day that the binmen come. The problem is you don't know if they're going to come on a Tuesday or a Wednesday. So if I'm not there, I have to text somebody else who lives in the block and get them to open the combination lock. That all sounds incredibly boring, but the point of the story is, when I went to close the bin store after the last visit from the binman, I opened up to make sure the bins were back in, and there was only one in the what they call the recycling shed. We've got two sheds. One.
So what did you say to the other bin? Where's you been?
Where's you been? That's right. Where's you been, man?
Oh, dear. We better not do accents.
No, we shouldn't. We get into trouble, won't we? But anyway, you know what I mean. Obviously, I thought there's something very odd here. How can you steal a bin? I mean, they're huge. They're huge bins. They're made of cast iron. They're on wheels. And, you know, you couldn't possibly lift them up. It would take 10 people to lift it onto the back of a lorry or something like that, you know. And I thought, well, what's happened here? Anyway, as I suspected, after a lengthy investigation by the local authority, unfortunately, the man in head of waste management is a long time listener of mine on TalkSport, which always helped, you know. And he was incredibly efficient and conducted an investigation within a few hours, found that these garbage lorries that lift the bins at the back and then tip the waste refuse into the back of your of the garbage truck sometimes malfunctions and the bin goes in as well. And that's exactly what happened.
Oh, yeah. So the truck swallowed the bin.
The device that lifts the bin up at the back of the garbage truck just went too far, and instead of just the lid opening and all the garbage coming out, the bin went over into the back of the lorry, and then you've got one ruined lorry, because if you get a huge bin like that thrown into the back of the garbage truck, it knackers up all the bits of the truck that mash up all the waste, you know what I mean?
My God, that must have cost a fortune. Imagine how much those bin lorries
are. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But anyway, within a couple of days of me getting on the case, we had a new bin. And I've never seen a new bin before. It's sparkling. I mean, bins usually look completely knackered, don't they? Because they've been filled full of rubbish so many times. But this is a brand new bin. I couldn't believe it. Anyway, that's...
It's so beautiful that you don't want to put any rubbish
in it.
No, I don't.
You know, I think, God, you know, it'd be an absolute shame. It literally sparkles. It's silver. It sparkles. But anyway, there we go. That's, a lengthy saga about my bin.
It's kind of first world problems, though.
It is first world problems, I agree. And you feel sometimes, don't you? What on earth are you moaning about losing a bleeding bin for? When,
you know, I nearly did, yeah.
When, you know, people in Ukraine would absolutely beg you to have a problem like that and not a problem of the house having been demolished by a Russian missile.
Exactly.
Now, Miss Jones, although it's a few days ago now, I must point out to the audience how impressed you were by the commemoration to Shane Warne. You were so thrilled. You rang me up. You said, have you seen this on the telly? It's amazing. A billion people around the world have tuned in to the MCG, that's Melbourne Cricket Ground, to commemorate the life of Shane Warne. Why were you so impressed by him?
I found it extraordinary. I happened to put the television news on and there it was. It was like a royal event. It seemed bigger to me than the funeral for Nelson Mandela. Mm. And probably more people around the world were watching it than watched Nelson Mandela's funeral. I could have done without the sobbing children. Mm. I think that all gets a bit kind of icky, doesn't it? You know, yes, of course, your dad was wonderful. We do feel very sorry for you that you haven't got your dad to knock around a ball with in the back garden anymore.
Yeah.
But we don't really need those very, very personal, intimate stories, do we? Mm. I think that sort of dragged it down a bit. Mm. But I think that as a public tribute to such an incredible sportsman who seemed to touch the hearts of so many people.
It
was a fitting tribute. Yeah. And it also had an elegance about it.
Yes.
It made me think about the way we do events like that in this country, actually.
Yes, no, I totally agree. I'm sure we've mentioned Shane Warne on a previous podcast, but of course we were off air for a month, so we may not have done. But I employed Shane Warne once, and I put this out on Twitter, and I paid him £5,000 every Friday for a month to come in and do a one-hour phone-in programme. And, I mean, we've never had such meltdown on the lines, you know what I mean? Everybody wanted to get in and talk to Shane Warne. And people said, wow, what an amazing amount of money for 1 hour, £5,000. But that's what he can command because he was the world's biggest cricket star. But the thing is, it wasn't the 1 hour on air with him. It was the few hours in the pub afterwards with me and Mr. Brazil and Shane Warne, in which you really got to know the guy. And he was a sensational fella. He was so down to earth, you wouldn't believe it. He didn't turn up with the entourage like people normally do. He turned up literally with a bag slung over his back with, you know, a pair of batting gloves that he'd worn, which he gave to us, and a ball that he'd used, you know, which we were going to auction and give money to charity and all that kind of stuff. He's just a lovely fella, and you love being in his company. You felt like you'd got to know him after 5 minutes.
Do you think the sporting prowess of somebody like Shane Warne excuses the outrageous behaviour, the infidelity,
the womanising? That's his personal life. You don't have to be a sports star to act like that, do you? Go and look in the City of London.
Well, that's true. But, you know, we get it all the time with rock stars and other kinds of celebrities, don't we?
Yeah.
And there is a school of thought that suggests that we have a right to know the personal life of a public figure.
Yeah. Well, look, it might sound very male to you, but I just found him such good fun. You know, whilst he was with me, giving me his time, having a few drinks and all that, I forgave him for any of his problem, you know, any of the lesser good things he'd done in life, because it was great being with him, you know. And there we are. But there we go. A bit of a shock when he went and all that. Do you know who Julie Goodyear is, Miss Jones?
Was she another one of your Corrie favourites?
Absolutely. And the reason I mention it is that today's her 80th birthday. She was Bette Lynch, and she was the landlady of the Rover's Return in Coronation Street, the world's most famous pub. And she was into excess. Beehive haircuts, earrings the size of saucers, you know, slap makeup on all over the place, lovely red lipstick on her lips, and, you know, flashing, you know, a distinctive bosom in leopard skin tops and all this kind of stuff. And she was...
A distinctive bosom?
Sorry?
A distinctive bosom?
Distinctive, yes. I think that was the fair...
That's what my father used to call a significant bazoom.
Oh, right, significant bazoom. Then there you go. And and she was the epitome of bad taste. In fact, she was such an epitome of bad taste. My sister, my eldest sister, has played hockey all her life. Unfortunately, she's had to curtail it recently because she's now a lady of a certain age and she's got a dodgy knee. But she played hockey all her life. Now, she's also a...
What was that last bit?
What was that?
You gabbled that last bit. I missed it.
Oh, no, I said she's a lady of a significant age, but now her knee's gone, she can't play hockey anymore.
All right, got it, yeah.
But anyway, point is, she's also a terrible snob. My sister's the sort of person, whenever she went on holiday somewhere really nice, you know, like to Australia to see the New Year's Eve fireworks or Hawaii or something like that, she'd send postcards to all the people she really didn't like, you know, to point out what a great time they were having, how expensive this holiday was and all that kind of stuff, you know. And
dear, what a waste of money.
That's a bit harsh. And when she went to play hockey, she never took her own car, which was quite a nice sort of BMW. She'd always take her husband's car, which was a 4x4 something, you know what I mean? And so that she made sure it was the best car in the car park when the girls were playing hockey. But the point of my story is all the other girls in the hockey team called her Bette because it was the complete opposite of what she is. Do you see what I mean? And it was to take the mickey out of it. Oh, here's Bette again, you know, with her highfalutin ways, and tried to bring her down by calling her Bette from the Rover's Return. But
how cruel people can be. I don't think I've seen Coronation Street since Ina Sharples was in it.
Golly, yeah. Well, I think I saw the first ever episode of Coronation Street. I'm sure I sat with my mum on the couch in Laurel Grove, Chester, when I was about, I think it came in 1960, I was about five, and I'm sure I remember the first episode. And you're right, Ina Sharples was the first distinctive woman. Listen, Miss Jones, have you tried to get across London lately in a taxi?
Ah, it's a nightmare. What has happened to London?
I'm telling you, the other day I finished a television show and then I had to go over to Victoria. So the television show was, near Blackfriars, and I had to get to Victoria. So that's going west to east in London. And I allowed 20 minutes because I had to meet up with my pal, Alan Brazil, actually. We were doing a sporting lunch. It took nearly an hour. And I could not believe, I mean, first of all, you've got roadworks everywhere. And I mean everywhere. Then you've got closed off roads. I don't know why they're closed off. I suspect it's to pedestrianise them, but they're just closed off and barriers all over the place. Then you've got traffic lights. The traffic lights only stay green for about five cars. And then they go to red again for 2.5 minutes. It was a blinking nightmare. And when we got to where I was going, we had to go around in circles again because, again, they'd closed off roads and made a load of them one way. I mean, there's an insidious plan to force cars out of London.
I agree with that. But what I think, it has occurred to me that perhaps they're paying people just to drive around London and congest it to the point that drivers with a purpose, with somewhere to go and be, will soon give up and say, oh, this is impossible. I can't drive in London anymore. It's too many cars. And they'll throw their cars away and start using public transport.
Yeah, and then the economy of London will collapse, because if you can't bring stuff into the city, that's my view anyway. But I mean, on some roads, there was one lane of traffic, another lane as wide as the traffic lane for bikes, and then a pavement twice the width of those lanes. It is, honestly, they are squeezing cars out of London. And by the way, to all our millions of listeners who don't live in London, please don't think I'm being London-centric here. I get reports from friends in Manchester, in Newcastle, Liverpool, Nottingham. It's happening everywhere. There is this underhand plan from unelected people to make motorists' lives extremely difficult.
Yep, I agree with that. But what happens in 5 years' time when we're all supposed to, well, we will have to, because it'll be the law, we will all have to drive electric cars only.
Yeah, there won't be anywhere to charge them up. And there's not enough electricity in this country anyway to fire those cars up. I mean, look, it's a nightmare. I mean, if their plan is to drive people off the road, they're succeeding with me. I am now so loath to take my car into London. I've got a very good train service from Surrey. The tube, I think, generally speaking, is pretty efficient. And that's the way I get around now, you know, and I wouldn't dream of it.
I always thought you didn't bring your car into town.
I don't know. That's what I'm saying. But occasionally, if I've got a late show or something like that, you know, it's easier to get home by taking your car. Although,
yeah, but it never is now, because it takes three times as long.
It's absolutely right. You're absolutely right. But anyway,
I once set off from Blackheath, which is SE3. Yeah. Which is, you know, on the southeastern kind of outskirts of London, I suppose, to drive to my friends in Chiswick, which is 17 miles away. Uh-huh. It took me over 5 hours.
Good God.
Yeah. And I said when I got there, but they were drunk when I got there, because I was supposed to be there for 5 o'clock for pre-dinner drinks. Yeah. And I think I ended up arriving about 7:45 or something.
Good God.
They'd already drunk all the wine and they were fighting by then because they were annoyed that I hadn't arrived. They were taking it out on each other. It was terrible.
That does sound terrible indeed. Yeah, there we go. Right. Okay, folks, that's it for another week. Thank you very much indeed for having joined us. Miss Jones, I think you've got a bit of adventure in the next few days, haven't you? So good luck with all of that. And you can tell our audience about it in our next podcast. And other than that, folks, just want to say thank you very much again for listening. Back with you next week. Funny you should say that, because it's not hanging well from my hips down, okay?
What's happened?
For the past couple of months, I've had strange sensations sort of around my midriff and in my back.
Do we want to know this?
Oh, yes. It's all perfectly family-oriented. Don't worry.
Ah, okay. Family show.
Sorry?
Family show.
Yeah, family show, absolutely.
Oh, I'm a bit croaky here this morning. But
yeah, I'm sorry about that. I think it's because, you know, we've had a few early mornings this week. What I was going to say was, so a couple of months ago, I got back from a job late at night, got out of the car, walked to my place, and then I have to step up one step to get to the door, and my right leg went underneath me, and I thought, that's funny, I must have slipped on, they must have polished the step or something like that, you know what I mean? Anyway, within a couple of days of me getting on the case, we had a new bin. And I've never seen a new bin before. It's sparkling. I mean, bins usually look completely knackered, don't they? Because they've been filled full of rubbish so many times. But this is a brand new bin. I can't believe it. Anyway, that's...
It's so beautiful that you don't want to put any rubbish in it.
No, I don't. You know, I think, God, you know, it'd be an absolute shame. It literally sparkles. It's silver. It sparkles. But anyway, there we go. That's, rather a lengthy saga about my bin. Flashing, you know, a distinctive bosom in leopard skin tops and all this kind of stuff. And she was...
A distinctive bosom?
Sorry?
A distinctive bosom.
Distinctive, yes. I think that was the fair...
That's what my father used to call a significant bazoom.
Oh, right, significant bazoom. Then there you go.